ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Louise Doughty grew up in the East Midlands, and her father's family were Romany, or as his people had been known for centuries in England, travellers or gypsies. Louise's great-great-grandfather was born in a church graveyard, and he and his wife were so poor they didn't even have a wagon of their own, sleeping instead in ditches and haystacks as they travelled around England and Wales working as fruit pickers. Louise's own parents had climbed into the working class, and they wanted their daughter to go further still, to get an education, a proper job, and a good, solid house. But Louise had other dreams. Her heart was set on being a writer. She made her first book at 11, a hardback that she constructed with the cardboard from cereal packets. Louise has now published her 10th novel. Her books are read around the world, and two have been turned into TV series, including the psychological thriller Apple Tree Yard, which was a hit on the BBC. Louise was at the recent Brisbane Writers' Festival to talk about her new book, A Bird in Winter. It's the story of a middle-aged spy on the run for her life. And in writing it, Louise put on her trench coat and went to a London hotel to meet the former head of MI5. Louise, your new book is called A Bird in Winter. Do you remember when that title came to you?
It actually came very late in the process. I really struggle with titles. I knew that she was going to be called Bird, and obviously there's a reference to she's in flight for most of the novel. And I knew that she was going to be heading north. The northern countries, the Nordic countries, she flees to Norway and Iceland. It gets colder and icier and more lonely the more her flight progresses. So I knew there was going to be something wintry, something about snow and ice, but it took a while to come up with the phrase.
Before you tell me what Bird does for work, tell me what she looks like.
What she looks like? I imagine her as quite small and quite wiry. Obviously, I'm sublimating something here because I'm tall and definitely nobody's ever accused me of being wiry, like a little soft and a little cake around the belly kind of gal. And I've always imagined her as one of these sort of tough little people. She says in the book, all my life people have underestimated me because I'm small. She's quite ordinary looking. She's in her 50s, and she's the kind of middle-aged woman that you would pass in the street and not particularly notice. And that obviously becomes important for her career.
Well, the fact that she just looks like an ordinary, everyday, middle-aged woman is a great advantage to her professionally. What does she do for work?
Well, she's a spy. But she's more than a spy. She's a spy who catches corrupt spies. So, first of all, after university, she's gone into the British Army. And then she's worked in the city for a bit in a secretarial role, but she's very bored. And then one day she gets what British intelligence call the tap on the shoulder. And she gets invited to lunch at a club, which is actually the way that British intelligence used to do it. Somebody would cross their path and you'd get a little note saying, you know, please come for lunch at my club, or please come and meet a friend who would be interested in seeing you. And this man who takes her to lunch at the club gently suggests that a woman of her talents is clearly wasted in what she's doing and would she like to do something more interesting? And she's recruited into the secret services that way. And she's not been a field agent for very long because that's not the bit that she enjoys. And as an MI5 officer, she doesn't enjoy running agents. That's not her forte. She's a bureaucrat. So as her career has progressed, she's gone into the huge bureaucracy, the civil service that supports a spying service. And I think this is something we forget about spies, in that, you know, the films are all about the guys who are running down the street and, you know, jumping out of moving vehicles. Those guys exist under certain circumstances, but spying is first and foremost a bureaucracy, and it's a massive bureaucracy, and it's part of the civil service in Britain. They're not actually paid that much. They're paid civil service rates. And Bird has spent many years comfortably working in an office. She's been moved to Birmingham for a specialist unit. And the idea of spies catching corrupt spies really interests me because, of course, if you're corrupt as a spy, you know exactly how to cover your tracks. And then if you're trying to catch a corrupt spy, you would have to be an uber spy. So the complexities of that really interested me. And at the point she has to go on the run, she's been a bureaucrat for a couple of decades, and suddenly she has to recover her training and her ferocity as a field agent because there are two sets of people on her tail and neither of them wish her well.
This description that you gave of Bird being tapped and invited to a private club, didn't something similar happen to you, Louise?
It did. I didn't notice it happening at the time, which is why I didn't get recruited by the Secret Services. But there was a whole phase, I now know, through my research, where the Secret Services do like recruiting journalists. Because, of course, journalists have a cast-iron excuse for nosing around and asking questions in other countries. And I was working, implausibly as it sounds, as a theatre critic for a newspaper in the UK. I was in my late 20s, early 30s, and not long after I got the job, I had a... This is way before the internet. I had a card from somebody saying, would you like to come and have lunch at my club? And I thought, I don't even know this man. You know, why does he want lunch at my club? And I just ignored it. And then about 6 months later, I had another card. And this time it was plural. It was, we are having a small lunch for people of influence at such and such a restaurant in a very smart hotel in Park Lane. Do please join us. And again, I sort of thought, well, who are these people? And I ignored it. And I've since been told that it is possible that those were, if you like, feelers being put out, which I hope they were. I mean, I'd be a bit disappointed if they were just random people who wanted to take me for lunch.
Do you regret not turning
up? Actually, I do. I regret being a bit dim about it and not realising at the time. But I didn't come from that kind of background. If I'd been to Oxbridge or had a parent in the civil service, I probably would have realised what it was. But, you know, I didn't, and I didn't realise.
And how did you twig to that? What point in your life do you look back and think, wait a minute?
Relatively recently, when I was doing the research for Bird in Winter, and I read a lot of spy novels and read a lot of accounts of British spying. And one of the problems with British spying is that for years and years and decades, it's been very reliant on the tap in the shoulder. You have the Cambridge spies, Burgess and Maclean, who betrayed Britain to the Soviet Union. And the reason they went undetected for so long, despite the fact that they reached very senior levels in the British Secret Service, was they were jolly good fellows. You know, so-and-so was in such-and-such college. He's such a good bloke. You know? And I think the British Secret Service has finally woken up to the fact that if you recruit from a very narrow pool of upper-class young men who went to Oxford and Cambridge, then you're actually going to get a pretty narrow Secret Service, and that's changed a lot now.
How do they recruit for the MI5 now?
Well, believe it or not, they did actually advertise on Mumsnet a few years ago, which caused much hilarity in the British press. You know, all these sort of bored middle-class North London mums who were sort of had enough of doing the school run were clearly thinking, great. And they did actually advertise in the newspapers. There was an advertisement I saw in the Evening Standard, which was more of a traditional spying advertisement. It was a man standing at a hotel window looking out, and the wording was something like, you know, do you like working alone? Come and work with us or something. So, no, they do openly recruit now. The recruitment process is a lot more rigorous than it used to be. It's not enough just to have gone to the right college at Oxford and Cambridge. And, you know, we now know who the head of MI5 and MI6 is. I mean, the first one was Stella Rimington, the first female head, and she wrote a memoir, I mean, not giving away many secrets. But she did talk about something which I put in Bird in Winter, which is Five Eyes, or the Kazab Nation, which is your spies as well as ours, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, America, and Britain. And Five Eyes all cooperate with each other. The spying services cooperate. And that was a big secret. Five Eyes or Kazab were kept very quiet for decades, but that's now openly known about. So the whole system has ostensibly come into the open, but of course there are huge areas that are...
You managed to have a meeting with a former head of MI5. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was great fun. I had a roundabout contact with Lord Evans of Weardale, who's a former head and now sits in the House of Lords, and through various contacts got in touch with him, and he agreed to meet me for an hour. And he suggested the cafe in the foyer of a London hotel, which just seemed blissfully appropriate to meet a head spy. And just before I left the house, it started pouring with rain. So I threw on a trench coat. And I was walking to this hotel, and I thought, oh, my God. And I turned up to meet him, and I could tell immediately he had a sense of humour. I said, I'm really sorry. It looks like I'm auditioning. There I was in the foyer of this hotel in a trench coat. And he did say, how long have you got?
And did he reveal much? What did you learn from that meeting?
He was absolutely charming, very friendly, very helpful, and revealed absolutely nothing. And the funny thing was, is I knew that he was going to reveal nothing, and he knew I knew. So in a way, we were just kind of sussing each other out, you know, that, and it was very interesting. I really just wanted to see what kind of person did become the head of MI5. I have had some situations where people have thought I was a spook. I went to Libya under Gaddafi for the British Council, and nobody there could understand why a novelist might be in Libya. And the Libyan Secret Service, who was sort of keeping an eye on me and Bernardine Evaristo, who's the other writer I was sent, just assumed, I think, that we probably worked for the Secret Service. And I remember chatting to the guy who was our, Sharif, who was our kind of minder, stroke bodyguard, stroke driver. And it was not long after the Madrid bombings. And he said, you know, it had been in the British papers that they were probably Al-Qaeda bombings. And he said, oh, it's not Al-Qaeda. Your government just want you to hate Arabs. It's probably ETA. And I said, well, you know, the evidence is that the kind of explosives that we used were not explosives that ETA has access to. It's more likely to be Al-Qaeda. And he said, how do you know that? And, of course, I'd read it in The Independent on Sunday. But Libya was a country where there was Soviet-style control of news. There was no free press. There was no way that an ordinary citizen would know about the type of explosives that we used in a bombing. That's not something that would be reported. And from that moment on, he just assumed I was a spook.
You said that you had, when you went into that meeting with a former head, you were partly just wanting to sense what sort of person would take on that role and how they might behave. I mean, your character, Bird, is nowhere near the head of that organisation. She's a much lower rank. But what kind of qualities does she have that make her a good fit for the work that she's done?
Well, she's calm and she's discreet. She's not interested in being a kind of flashy, show-off sort of person. Her work is her life. She's never married. She doesn't have children. She's got an aging widowed mother who she looks after. And she has a close female friendship that she developed in the British Army with a woman called Flavia. But she is somebody whose work is her life, really. She says at one point, you know, I became the competent workaholic that everybody wanted when they wanted a job done well. Mm.
That friendship with Flavia is at such a contrast to every other relationship in her life. It's really the only kind of human connection that feels that it's really pierced her. And it's not a love affair, but you sort of think that Bird wants it to be or wonders if it should be. And it's certainly more meaningful than any of the relationships she has with the men that she sleeps with.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are moments where you think that relationship could have tipped over into something sexual. But Bird is quite a repressed character. Flavia is straight, and it never quite becomes what it could have become. And I was very interested in writing about the nuances of those really intense romantic friendships we have, where if our sexuality was just turned a notch, it might have become something else, but it never quite does. And in the meantime, you know, she sleeps with men, but she doesn't have the emotional connection, as you say, with any of the men that she sleeps with.
Partly that's because all of her relationships are transactional. She's always her professional self. Everyone that she meets, she's thinking, how do I get some advantage in this scenario, or how might they be trying to take advantage of me? That comes also from the training that she's been given in her line of work. She's taught, along with other trainees, how to sweep a room. What does that mean in this context?
Sweeping a room is something that any spy will do when they walk into a room. So let's say a spy joined this event just before it started. Without any of you noticing, she would have clocked everybody in the room. And the thing about sweeping a room is it's not just a matter of looking around to notice things. It's a matter of looking around to notice things without anybody noticing that that's what you're doing. With a lot of the cops that I've interviewed for various books, where you go into a cafe and they will always sit with their back to the wall, because they want to see everybody, even if they're off duty. It's just become such an ingrained habit. And I am now at the stage where if I was going to meet a cop or a spy in a pub, I could walk in and I could go, oh, it's you. You know, eating the back to the wall, they're noticing everything without being noticed. And what interested me is, you imagine that's your professional life. What does that do to your personality? Because after a while, it becomes instinctual. And you can't go into any room without sweeping the room. And how does that affect your relationships with other people? Mm-hmm. And I think that must be a very complicated thing.
She reflects that the person who's trained her in this or introduced this idea to her says, you know, even when you retire, this is just a skill that you have. And he almost says it's a gift. It's like you can read other people's minds. And so every time Bird meets someone, she's thinking, imagining in quite detailed ways what their house would look like, what sort of food they'd have. And in that way, she struck me as maybe being a bit like a novelist. She's always making up stories about the people she meets.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, spying and novel writing have certain things in common. And, you know, maybe I am just a spy or a detective who can't run. Who knows?
The novel begins in Birmingham, as you say, but once Bird realises that she's in danger, she heads north into Scotland and beyond. Tell me about a story you had heard about another woman in Norway who partly inspired this journey that Bird makes.
Yes, I mean, this is a very strong inspiration for the book. I'd already had the idea about wanting to write about a woman on the run. And I had envisaged the very opening scene of the book, where she gets up in the middle of a meeting, and as she rises from her chair, she's thinking, it's no more than 30 paces to the lift. And I already knew that I wanted her to end up in the Nordic countries, in Norway and Iceland. And I went on a walking holiday up to the Norwegian fjords. And because of that, I discovered a podcast called Death in Ice Valley. And it's about a real-life mystery which obsesses Norway. It's almost their sort of who shot JFK. And it happened in the early 70s. A man was out walking with his daughters in a valley called Ice Valley, a very bleak valley outside Bergen. And they discovered the body, the partially burned body of a woman. And various objects were around the woman, almost in a quite rich, ritualistic way. They reported it to the police. The police came, and inside the pocket of the woman's coat, there was a ticket for left luggage at Bergen Railway Station. And they went to Bergen Railway Station and got out a suitcase, and inside the suitcase were 14 false passports, all with the same photograph, but different names and different nationalities. The Norwegian Secret Service descended. The case was declared closed, and officially it was a suicide. Now, she had smoke in her lungs. This was not a suicide. And she was buried in an unmarked grave with only a couple of policemen there. And, you know, who is the Istval woman, the woman in Death in Ice Valley, is a mystery that's persisted ever since. And the podcast traces, any sighting or any evidence about her. And miraculously, they did discover that although she was buried, her jawbone that they removed during the post-mortem was still at the university, and they were able to do a kind of radioactive isotope analysis on the jawbone and discover things about her. And the case is not resolved.
But where was she from? What did they find out with that DNA?
They found out, they think, with the analysis, that she was probably born near Nuremberg in Germany in the early 1930s. And then she left Germany. There was some evidence she might have come to the UK as a child. She was dark-haired, sallow-skinned, obviously had some kind of support from a secret service. And in the 1970s, there was a lot of Soviet activity. It's the height of the Cold War that Soviet submarines were coming very close to Norway, even into the fjords. And Norway was one of these countries that was sort of on the borderline of the Cold War. And she had been seen in Stavanger talking to a submarine captain. They think that possibly she was a kind of freelance spy, but possibly hired by someone like Mossad to find out more about what the Soviets were up to. But they, as far as I know, they still don't know for sure. But I couldn't get this woman out of my head. I thought, who was she? You know, she was very long way from home. Why was she there? And how lonely she must have been, you know, working in Norway on her own, multiple different false identities. And I think her fate and her identity sort of still possess me, really. And to a certain extent, she became the inspiration for Bird.
And then you decided that you would go on the run yourself, to an extent, Louise. You headed off from Birmingham. Where to?
I did. Well, I'd already been to Norway and Iceland, and then a little thing in human history happened called a global pandemic. And the irony of trying to write a novel about a woman who goes on the run at a time in human history where we were all trapped in our homes did not escape me. So the minute restrictions lifted, I was just out of there. And the big gaping hole in this novel was the journey from Birmingham up to the west coast of Scotland, Glasgow, the Inner Hebrides, the Western Isles, then over to Inverness, up to Thurso, and then Orkney and Shetland. So that was the bit I did. I got as far as Orkney. And one of the first things, if any of you are thinking of going on the run, I'm going to tell you now, certainly in the UK, and I'm sure it's true here, you can't use a car because of automatic number plate recognition. You won't get more than a few miles down the road. So she has to go on trains, buses, on foot and ferries. She has to use various disguises. And that's what I did. I followed her route. I went off on my own. I had a rucksack on my back and a beanie hat. And I was completely on my own for a couple of weeks, staying one night at a time in guest houses. And I didn't, in the novel, she crosses the North Sea and enters Norway illegally on a yacht. I didn't do that bit. I have a very weak stomach. And I didn't sleep rough. In the book, she does sleep rough. I'm afraid I did opt for a comfy guest house bed.
So what did you learn about her and that journey by doing that? Because you could have just sat in your nice home in London and typed it up, looked at Google Maps. Why did you want to do it?
I learned everything about her. I learned about what she might be thinking if she really believed. There's a point in her flight where she realizes she's being pursued, and there's a point where she stays in a very creepy, deserted apartment. And that's something that happened to me with an automatic light that keeps going on and off in the hallway, which, of course, she thinks is somebody entering the building, but actually it's, you know, just a dust mote drifting down. And there is a scene in the book that's based very directly on what happened to me when I got a long bus ride up from Inverness up to Thurso, which is the very, very tip of the British Isles. It takes about 4 or 5 hours. And I arrived after dark, and it was the last stop, and I got off the bus, and the bus pulled away, and the other people melted into the night, and I was on my own with my rucksack, and I had to find a guest house. And it was one of these old stone towns. There was nobody on the streets. You know, it was the wind was whistling, the waves were crashing against the pebbles, and I had to head out of town to find this guest house. And in the novel, that becomes a scene where she realizes, she looks back and she sees a pool of light around a lamppost, and shadows, and she realises she's being followed.
Well, when you describe it in that way, Louise, it strikes me that one of the reasons why women might actually be really good spies is that from a very young age we're sort of trained to be alert to potential dangers in our surroundings.
Absolutely, that's 100% true. You know, we are instinctively used to the idea that we may become prey. And, you know, you get off the tube or a bus and you put the keys between your fingers as you walk to your own front door. And then the minute you're safely home, you just forget all about it. But you become instinctively used to reading the room, reading the street, working out what your surroundings are, where potential threat might come from. So that element of the book was not hard to imagine at all. It's something that we do instinctively.
Were there things that you enjoyed about that solo journey?
I loved everything about it. I really did. I mean, after being trapped at home for a couple of years, it was fantastic. And the rather sweet thing that is, in real life, a lot of the time, as opposed to feeling in a situation of threat, I had the opposite, which is people would keep trying to adopt me. You know, I'd be sitting in a restaurant or a pub and there'd be a couple at the table next door and they'd be going, "Oh, Paul, look, do you think he left her?" "Yeah, I know." And then they'd say, "Oh, would you like to join us?" And the other thing was I would often sit with a notepad or my laptop, and the maitre d' would come over and start explaining where he sourced his wild garlic. And I realised they thought I was a food blogger or critic, because why else would I be in a restaurant on my own? So, yeah, most of the time, apart from the dark walks and the walks on my own where the phone signal went in remote areas, they were very spooky. But for a lot of the time, I felt completely safe and was actually having to kind of fend people off.
Podcast. Broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Konoski. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app. Or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Bird traverses a lot of territory in this novel. Does she go anywhere near the part of England that you grew up in?
No. No, she stays well out of the East Midlands. I mean, Birmingham is the West Midlands, and Coventry, where she grows up. I have written about the East Midlands. My third novel, Honeydew, was set in the town where I grew up. Platform 7, my ninth novel, was set mostly on Peterborough Railway Station. Slightly odd place to set a novel. Let's just say it's not one of the most glamorous areas UK.
What is Melton Mowbray famous for?
Melton Mowbray, where I was born, is famous for its pork pies. And in fact, my maternal grandfather, my mother's father, was a baker. He was a master baker. And my grandparents met in a pork pie factory. And it was his job to raise the pastry, the short-cusp pastry, round a lump of meat. And my grandmother's job, Jessie, it was her job to pour the molten jelly in that settles round the meat and pastry. And granddad fellows would actually tour country fairs demonstrating how to make a proper hand-raised pie. And as a result of this, I am a terrific pork pie snob. And if you bring home any of that supermarket rubbish, I will throw it at your head. So here's a top tip for tonight. A proper hand-raised pie, the sides should always be saggy. If the sides are straight, it was baked in a tin. Don't touch it. The meat should be grey, not pink, and very peppery, and there should be a proper thick layer of jelly in between. So, yes, I am. We used to have pork pie for breakfast on Christmas morning as a sort of.
I thought you were going to say treat. For breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but no, it was just. So, reveals my ignorance about cooking. How do you make it stand up if it's not in a tin, the pastry?
Well, you raise it round the meat and the jelly kind of adheres to the inside of the pastry and to the meat. I know it doesn't sound that appetizing now I describe it, but trust me, it's a delicacy where I come from.
What sort of value was placed on education in your family home, Louise?
A huge amount. So my mother had been a village lass, you know, the daughter of a baker. She had left school at 15 and then done her secretarial training, which is what you did if you were a clever working class girl. Otherwise, it was, you know, being a working on the farm or in a factory. My father had left school at 13 and he grew up in Peterborough, and he had actually won a place at grammar school, and then his mother had seen the price of the uniform and said, "We can't afford that, you ain't going." And so he went to the local rough school, and one day in the playground, a teacher gave him a backhander so hard it threw him against the wall, and he walked out of the playground and never went back. But later in life, for reasons that I've never been entirely clear about, he became obsessed with educating himself. So he went to elocution classes to learn how to talk proper, as he said. He read the complete works of Shakespeare from cover to cover, because that was educated people did. He did his lower and higher certificates, as they were called then, at night school. And he took an external degree and ended up in his, would have been mid-50s. I mean, I remember going, he ended up getting a PhD, and it took him until his 50s. But he really wanted to have the highest education that he could get, having missed out. It did mean he was absolutely obsessed with us all going to university, completely obsessed, to the extent that made adolescence a little difficult. But it was everything to him. It was the root out of his working class background. I wouldn't say we were kept away from our working class relatives, but we were certainly taught that we were different. And, you know, my cousins backed me up on this. I saw my cousin Roy recently, and he said, "Oh, yeah," he said, "we were always told to mind our P's and Q's when you were coming over. You know, you were the posh ones in the family. And, you know, we got a good clip round the ear."
He had come from not just a working class family, but a Romani family. What do you know about his mother and grandmother and their story?
Yes, I think it does explain a lot, because social mobility was so important to him, because becoming working class was a step up in many ways in social terms. His mother had been born by the side of the road. So his mother came from a Romani clan called the Smiths, and his mother's father, my father's grandfather, was a Romani called George Smith, or his family name was Tabletop on account of his flathead. And Tabletop was born in a graveyard in a village outside Peterborough called Werrington in 1875. And it's still there in the parish records. I've seen it, Gypsy Boy Born in the Graveyard. And his mother was an illiterate teenage Romani girl. Nobody really knows who Tabletop's father was. She went by the name of Spank.
Spank.
I have pictures of her, because she lived to a ripe old age. She was very small and very fierce. And they worked as fruit pickers with their clan. In the 19th century, it was traditional. Romanies moved from one harvest to the other throughout the year. And they were working as fruit pickers on a Cambridgeshire estate. And the family story was that the landowner's daughter, who went by the name of Hepzibah Lavinia O'Dell, came round collecting the rent from the gypsy caravans, fell in love with Tabletop, and apparently when her father found out that she was consorting with gypsies, he horsewhipped her, took her clothes away and locked her in her room. And the story was that she climbed out of the window and shinnied naked down the drainpipe. Now, I've seen pictures of Hepzibah, and I'm sorry, I cannot imagine her shinnying down anything, let alone naked. I think that bit of the story is stretching the imagination. But what is established is they ran off to East Cambridge together, they eloped, they got married, and she sent word to her family that she was going to be legally wed, but none of them came to the funeral because she'd disgraced them.
None of them came to the wedding.
Sorry, the wedding. God,
that's what they were
Freudian
thinking.
Slip. None of them came to the wedding. And she was cast out by her family. But her father did pay for the church bells to be rung as they came out of the church. Although apparently Heppy said, according to my Aunt Betty, quite often, it would have been better if one of the bells had fallen off and killed a stone dead. Such a miserable time she had with George. She was cast out by her own family, but she was never accepted by the travellers either, because she was a gorger, which is pejorative for non-travellers, and her children were half and halves. which is what my father's mother was, which is also pejorative. And the first time Spank met her new daughter-in-law, apparently she said, "You've married my son and you'll sup sorrow by the spoonful till the day you die." Which I think we can all agree is not a good start to mother-in-law and daughter-in-law relationships. So she had a tough life, came to a tough end. They didn't even have a Vado, which is a Romany wagon. They were living in ditches by the side of the road. But they had five children, so it can't have been all bad. The youngest of which was my father's mother. And she died in 1929 of stomach cancer in her 50s, so pretty tough time. And her hated mother-in-law, Spank, outlived her by two decades. She lived into her 90s, so she died in 1949. And when his mother died, Tabletop opened up his wife's grave and put his mother on top.
Oh, my gosh.
And I have visited this graveyard. It's in Peterborough itself, the Wellington Road graveyard. And my father showed it, and it's got Hepzibah, Lavinia, but Tabletop was illiterate, so he misspelled his own wife's name. It's Hepzibah with an R on the end as opposed to an H. And then underneath also of Caroline Lee, which was his mother's name. And I remember standing by this grave and looking at it and thinking, oh, I can feel a novel coming on. Let me lie down till it goes away. And the irony of these two women who had hated each other for decades and yet were somehow curiously bound to each other in this love triangle. You know, Spank had given birth to her only son as an illegitimate child when she was a teenager. And then Hepzibah had given up everything to run away from her family. And by all accounts, Tabletop was a complete ne'er-do-well, completely unworthy of the love of either of these women. And he's buried in a far corner on his own in an overgrown grave. And yet these two women are sort of together for all eternity. So that's Stone Cradle, my fifth novel. Although I did have to change the names, sadly, because certain family members, you don't... I mean, these family members are not with us anymore, so I can name them publicly. But generally in Romany culture, you don't use family names to outsiders.
Did you grow up knowing all of these stories? Is this a history that your father spoke to you about?
No. Dad was very cagey about it because he was desperate for us all to be nice middle-class kids. And we did used to go to family get-togethers, great aunt Lenders, big house. A couple of my Romany aunts married Ukrainians who had come as displaced persons after the war. So we had all these Ukrainian relatives. There'd be these big get-togethers. And the traveller side of the family would fall to rockering, as it's called, speaking in Ruminus, Anglo-Romani dialect. And I'd ask Dad, and he'd say, "Oh, take no notice." But my cousins could rock her. And I always knew there was something my cousins knew that I didn't. But our father was quite obsessed with social mobility. He did not want us to even really acknowledge the traveller side of our family. And I had a lot of resistance from him and indeed from other family members when I started writing and talking about it publicly. And in fact, Stone Cradle and Fires in the Dark, which is my other Romany novel, both had to wait until my Uncle Ray had retired because he was a builder. And he said, "I'll lose work if people find out we're gypsies. I won't get jobs."
Is there still that level of prejudice against?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
Romany.
100%. Yeah, it's kind of Europe's own homegrown racism, really. And, you know, Europe's very fond of pretending that somehow racism is a problem that exists in other countries. But, I mean, Romanies were slaves, like the black people in the deep south of America, in Romania, an area called Wallachia, up until the 1850s. They were bought and sold. It was, you know, Romany hunting. You know, rumour is that that still exists in remote areas in Romania and Hungary. And there are ghettos. And in, you know, countries like Hungary and Romania, the ghettos are very, very fiercely divided from the majority population. English Romanys, which is what my clan were, Cambridgeshire Smiths, and Welsh Romanys are genetically related to European Roma. There was a big migration of what's commonly known as Caldarash or Coppersmith gypsies, one in the mid-16th century and another mid-19th century, which is when my lot came over, whereas Scottish and Irish travellers are indigenous to Scotland and Ireland and are very fair-skinned and an English or Welsh Romanichal who married a Scottish or Irish traveller would be considered to have married out. Mm. It would be those groups are considered quite distinct.
Finding all of that out and doing the research that you did for those books, Louise, did it leave you with a different sense of your own identity, given that it wasn't something that you were raised up knowing? How do you hold it in your sense of yourself?
Well, really, it just left me with a very acute sense of my own privilege and a real feeling of wanting to honour the ancestors, which is not the same thing as thinking they were all angels. I mean, you know, Tabletop was clearly something of a ne'er-do-well on many levels. But a really strong sense. I mean, my father's grandfather on the other side of the family, on his father's side, grew up in a Victorian workhouse where he went by the name of Pauper 57. And, you know, a couple of years after my father had died, I got contacted in the UK and asked to prepare my entry for Who's Who, you know, which is this sort of great, you know, important people magazine. And I did look at it and I think, oh, crikey, you know, if my dad was alive, that would really mean a lot to him, you know, that the family goes from Pauper 57 to Who's Who. But the linchpin of that transition was him and his obsession with education and his obsession with the idea that his children would have more privileged lives than him. And he succeeded, you know.
So what did he think about your wish to become a storyteller, a novel writer?
Well, he was very suspicious for a very long time. He would have liked me to be, you know, in the civil service or the BBC or something nice and respectable. And the idea that I wanted to be anything freelance or artistic was a bit of an issue for him. And he remained very sceptical about it. And, I mean, he never said anything about my novels. I sent him Fires in the Dark, which is about the Romani Holocaust, and he said, read your book, didn't care for it. That was it. The only other comment he made was my second novel, Dance With Me, when I sent it to him. He rang me up, he said, yeah, I read your book. You got a copy there. I said, yeah. He said, page 46, second paragraph, that first line, and there was a typo that had slipped through, and he said, got that wrong, didn't you? So that's the nearest I had to a review from my dad. And yet, when I went home, the neighbours would stop me in the street and say, oh, your dad's so proud of you. Mm. Oh, your dad never stops talking about what you're up to. And, oh, yes, he heard you on the radio the other day, came round to tell us. But no, I never had a word of praise directly.
I must say, I think you should, with respect, go to where he's buried and open the grave and stick in some of those novels in the family tradition, you know, like leave him for all eternity with that. I think it'd be reasonable payback. You wrote your first book when you were just 11, I believe. Can you share the title of this foray into fiction?
I took myself extremely seriously at that stage, and I'd been an avid reader as a child, thanks to the local library, and I decided at 11 I was going to write my first novel. And my first act, my first creative act, was to go into the pantry and find a box of cereal and empty all the cereal into a bowl. My mother was thrilled, you can imagine. And then cut up the cereal box and turn it over to the blank side and stick it to the covers of a school exercise book, because my book was going to be a hardback. Anyway, it was called Billy Mustang, and it was about a group of horses living, loving and laughing on the plains of the Midwest of America, which, seeing as I'd never left the East Midlands and was terrified of animals, was not a natural choice. But my father used to watch John Wayne movies that were always, cowboy movies were always on the television in the UK in the 1970s. If there was no sport on a Saturday or Sunday, it was cowboy movies. So they were very much sort of part of our growing up. And then there was the big children's hit of the era, which some of you may remember, Watership Down. Do you remember that? The talking rabbits. So the anthropomorphization of furry creatures was quite big. I decided I was going to write my own Watership Down, but it was going to be horses. I'd never sat on one in my life. I don't know what I was thinking.
I think that should be the next of your books that's put to TV, is Billy Mustang. I think its time has come. So you left this part of the Midlands to go away to university, as your father had hoped that you would. Was it almost a culture shock for you to be in a university in a city away from family?
In a city, I'd never spent a night in a city until I went to university. I'd never eaten in a restaurant. We didn't go out for dinner. I mean, there wasn't money for frivolities like that. I'd never flown in an aeroplane. I'd never spent a night in a hotel. You know, holidays we would go caravanning for a couple of weeks. So it was a huge culture shock. And what was odd was, because our parents had raised us to be as middle class as possible, I actually spoke more posh than a lot of other students who came from much wealthier backgrounds than I did. So I remember, you know, our parents would say, it's not can I, it's may I, you know, and a lot of that kind of elocution forced into us, you know, don't say calf, it's common. You know, we weren't allowed to wear jeans because jeans were common. We had some very nice navy slacks. That made me popular at school. So there was this odd thing. I mean, you know, Britain is obsessed with class and the signifiers of class. And realizing that I was kind of all at sea, hanging out with students who had come from backgrounds much more well off than mine, but who dropped their H's, who swore a lot more than I did, who spoke differently, who went out for meals, even though we were poor students. And I still remember being baffled by the concept of starters. It's like, what? You have a snack just before you have dinner. You know, what about spoiling your appetite? And particularly these starters that were like bread. It's like what you fill up just before you have your meal. And it took me a long while to feel at home in the outside world. I don't know how many of you have grown up in very small towns, but, you know, the world can be very small if you don't travel at all during your youth and you grow up in a small town. It takes a long time to understand the register of the outside world.
You turned 60 last year. Congratulations, Louise. How did you feel as you approached your birthday?
It was odd because it coincided with publishing Bird in Winter, which was my 10th novel. And they happened within a few days of each other. So it did feel a bit like a watershed. Both my children are now in their 20s. And it was like, oh, is this strange idea that most of my books tend to fall into three parts. You know, quite naturally, that's the way the imagination seems to work. And I think a lot of our lives fall into three parts. I mean, particularly if you've had children, you know, there's your pre-child rearing decades, then the kind of two or three decades you lose doing that. And then what a lot of people call the third act. And, you know, even if you haven't had children, it can still divide up between, you know, childhood and youth and your working life and then retirement. And of course, nowadays, you know, a lot of us get 25, 30 years for that third act. And what is it? You know, we're hopefully got most of our own teeth. You know, we're relatively healthy, and there could be a long stretch. So, yeah, I thought about it a lot, and I did feel a bit sort of
you
all
had
at sea,
a little itchy feet, a little bit
I
sort
did.
Of thinking.
I
what
did do a little bit more running away?
Yeah. Well, what invitation offered you a lifeline out of your everyday as a nice entree into the third act?
It did. I got invited to the Ubud Festival on Bali, and I kind of fibbed to my family. I said, "Oh, yeah, I think they want me for quite a long time." So, I went out and I taught a writing course. I did the festival, and then I was sent to the island of Flores, which is sort of halfway to East Timor from Bali. From there, I went to a tiny island called Seraya Kecil, which is out in the Flores Sea. I went to a port called Labuan Bajo, and then just got on a wooden boat with a couple of fellas and went off into the Flores Sea to this, I mean, I was going to call it a resort. It's not really a resort. It's a sort of series of wooden huts on the beach with a restaurant attached. And I did a lot of snorkeling off the beach and sitting and staring at the sea and getting up before sunrise and climbing the hill to watch the sunrise. And yeah, it was something I really, really needed to do.
And what clarified for you in that time away from your everyday life about what you wanted for this next stage?
That's a very good question, and I'm not sure I can answer it. I think it made me realise that I still crave unpredictability, that I'm not done yet with running away. And I mean, I didn't speak to anyone from home while I was away. I would occasionally get messages on WhatsApp saying the cat's thrown up, you know, none of which made me feel like I wanted to rush home, funnily enough. There is that odd feeling of, we're also solipsistic, that when we're in the world, we can't imagine the other parts of the world without us. So when I'm away, I do think about home, and it does feel a bit like I've made it up. And then equally, when I go home, it feels a bit like I've made up the thing I've come home from.
Is there more novel writing, though, in this third act?
Definitely, yes. There will. I have this awful thing. It's a really bad, tasteless habit. Whenever a novelist dies, I look up how many books they wrote before they popped it. Martin Amis, 15. It does seem to me like between 15 and 20 would be a good hit rate, you know. And I've got to 10. I'm in double figures. That's okay. You know, that's more than some novelists. But yeah, I reckon I can go between 15 and 20 before I shuffle off.
There you are, all thinking, what's driving a novelist to express themselves poetically, and really Louise is looking up the hoo-hoo and going, I've got to beat Martin Amis. And for that, let's applaud her.
Louise Doughty was a guest at the Brisbane Writers' Festival, and her latest novel is called A Bird in Winter. This conversation was produced by Nicola Harrison and recorded on the lands of the Jagera and Turrbal people. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hi, I'm Richard Roxburgh. You may know me as Cleaver Green, the smart-ass barrister in the TV series Rake. Cleaver would love the rogues and grifters in the new series, Great Aussie Cons. You'll learn how to counterfeit banknotes, how to extort money out of airlines, how to spend years pretending to be an English baronet. Sounds too good to be true, but it is, I swear to you. Great Aussie Cons on the History Listen. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.